TSN 1290, CFRW Winnipeg. All sports, baby! All the time. A division of Bell Media.
If you want to know the real deal about the three, we're going to take you with triple chops, y'all. We're going to bring you up to speed.
TSN 1290 presents the Illegal Curve Hockey Show with Drew Mandel, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg.
Good afternoon, Winnipeg. Good afternoon, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this afternoon on TSN1290.ca, good afternoon, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by my friends and colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. 3 hours of hockey talk ahead for you on this Saturday afternoon. Beautiful Saturday afternoon, I might add. We're going to spend the first hour talking about the Stanley Cup playoffs. The second hour will be focused on Blake Wheeler and his RFA situation with the Winnipeg Jets. And then in the third hour, a couple of interviews. One dealing with the upcoming NHL draft, an interview with Dave Faulkner. He's a Western Hockey League scout. And then an interview with Andrew Gross, who covers the New York Rangers. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/Illegal Curve. And our website with the latest Winnipeg and NHL news is www.illegalcurve.com. Richie, Ezzy, good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you doing both?
Good afternoon, Drew. Great intro, as always. It is a beautiful day, but it's not a beautiful day for the Pittsburgh Penguins. Unbelievable. We're going to talk about this quite a bit in the first hour, but wow, I'm shocked as much as anybody. Or everybody, I should say, about what happened yesterday. But, you know, the writing was on the wall after that third game in overtime. But, Wow, the Pittsburgh Penguins are going to have probably a longer summer than they wanted to, because they were going for it, and absolutely shocking. Kudos to the Boston Bruins. We're going to see a heck of a Stanley Cup Finals, whether it's the Hawks or Kings. But last night, it kind of felt like, you know, what's going on here with the Penguins?
Yeah, fair enough. As it was 3 years ago today that the Penguins won the Cup over Detroit.
That's right. In that Game 7 Classic.
That's right, in that Game 7 Classic with the save by Fleury, who couldn't stop a beach ball now. More concerned to me, though, is where's Michael Remus?
Really? You're concerned about that? Isn't it sort of par for the course? We expect to see him about 15, 20 minutes into the show at this point?
I think we need a little bit. We need him to step up his game.
Well, yeah. I was with Hustler last night, because Huss is my boy.
Yeah.
Shout out to Huss. He's on his. He might be in the U.S. actually. He's
going golfing. He tweeted that he crossed the border.
He's going golfing.
I guess that's an accomplishment for Huss and every time.
But you know, I'm with Huss last night at a local watering hole. And, You know, Remus didn't come out. We had a our team. I didn't play because I'm injured right now. But we had a hockey game and Remus played, and then he wouldn't come out. You know, Remus is doing the Bruce Buffer impersonation. By the way, Greg won that. Shout out to Greg Liverpool, who won the Bruce Buffer.
I missed it yesterday. Yes.
Bruce Buffer, for those who don't know, is the UFC. Ring announcer.
That's right.
Does the intros. But
the brother of Michael Buffer.
Remus is on the warm-up. He does the round table. Never late with Rick round table. Remus, late for our show.
Yeah.
No big deal. We've been doing it for over four years. Remus doesn't show up to the Saturday Illegal Curve show. It's unbelievable.
Well, we'll deal with Remus when he gets here, appropriately off-air, as you imagine. Let's start with the Boston-Pittsburgh series, which ended last night. I tell you what, I mean, I don't know what the odds are, and I don't know what the betting line was, but... I think you could have made a couple dollars betting on Boston to sweep Pittsburgh 4-0, and then you could really have cleaned up if you'd said that Malkin and Crosby would go pointless in that series.
Yeah.
You know, the first question I have is, you know, the manner in which Boston defeated Pittsburgh. I think, would you guys agree that this is one of the most stunning results you've seen in hockey in the last few years?
That they beat them isn't stunning, but the way they beat them, Drew, as you mentioned, it is stunning. For a team with as much talent as Pittsburgh to go out in 4 games, for the two best players arguably in the league to go pointless, nobody would have believed you if you said this before. They would have thought you were crazy. And, you know, there's going to be an evaluation period here for Pittsburgh. We'll talk, I guess, about Pittsburgh in the next segment, but I think Boston has to, you know, get a lot of credit. Because I love the way Boston's team is built, and I think the operative word there is team. There's continuity. We've had Jack Edwards on the show numerous times this year from Nesson in Boston. They cover the Bruins games there. And if you look at their roster, everybody's been there for a while. Give or take a guy or two. There's continuity on the team. The guys have chemistry. They play together. Like they'll add in a guy like Jágr. But they're not switching things up all the time. These guys play together all the time. You know, Krejci and Horton and Lucic and Chara. And they'll mix up the defensive pairings a bit. But you see a team on the ice. Like, they play together. And I don't mean sticking up for each other only. I mean, as a five-man unit, and I've said it on the show a bunch of times this year, they're the best five-man unit team in the league. They play. Everything's in sync. Everybody's where they're supposed to be. If one guy goes there, that comes with continuity. That comes with talent. Comes with team building. I just love what they represent. And I know some people don't like them. I think they're interesting to watch because they have skill, grit, heart, goaltending. I mean, there's nothing really, to me, there's nothing not to like about the team.
Richie, you mentioned continuity, and I think that's an extremely good point. They put in a guy like Torrey Krug, who ends up playing on D in place of Dougie Hamilton, and obviously they didn't go to Wade Redden because he wasn't playing well. He was playing in the first round, but you mentioned continuity. That's why a guy like Torrey Krug can come into the lineup essentially out of nowhere and play. He's a young guy. And remember, in the last round, he had 4 points, and he hasn't produced as much, but he didn't need to. But, you know, they started off the series, Boston did, with the shutout in Game 1, and then there was the Game 2 where Vokoun was pulled, and then Fleury went back in. Then the last two games were one-goal games. There was the double OT game. The Bergeron got the OT winner. And essentially, in the last two games, Pittsburgh played their best hockey of the series. The first two games, Pittsburgh was not good.
Pittsburgh scored 2 goals in 4 games.
They scored 2 goals in 4 games.
That's a team that would score 4 goals in a period.
Right, and the thing is, in that third game, I think they had 7 or 8 power plays. They didn't score a power play goal. Boston, for that matter, didn't score a power play goal either. It's unbelievable that these two teams couldn't score a power play goal in 4 games. And it's not like there was a few power plays. There was a lot. But
Boston's power play has been at the bottom of the league for the last couple of years. So that's a lot less... Yep. Stunning.
That's a good point.
And they won the cup, as I think Jack said on our show. They won the cup against Vancouver and didn't score a power play goal in that series.
And Pittsburgh in 2009 didn't have a good power play, with Crosby and Malkin, 4 years ago. But obviously that third game was a killer. The double OT game was a killer. But it's shocking in the sense, Drew, you know, you asked how shocking it is, and it is shocking that they didn't win a game. But perhaps the most shocking is that no one produced. And it's not just Crosby or Malkin. I mean, you had a lack of anything, any offensive creativity. And I know a lot was talked about as far as, you know, Crosby, was he injured? And remember Daniel Paille yesterday had the hit on Crosby. When Crosby was looking the other way, Paille hit him. And they were talking about that on CBC. And something was not right with Crosby. And it's not like he didn't get any scoring chances, but what's almost the most surprising about the way Crosby performed? No points. Sure, everyone knows Crosby and Malkin didn't have any points. But it was just his energy level, and, you know, he had the jaw protection taken off. I thought this was going to be another great performance by Crosby, and you have to wonder what happened there. And was it the first game when he just couldn't figure out, how to deal with Boston's defense, a guy like Chara or Bergeron on him all the time. He almost seemed defeated in this series.
Crosby stood out to me twice in the entire series. The first time was in Game 1 when he lost his cool.
Yeah.
The second time was in the overtime of Game 3 when he lost his helmet and went on that and had that shift where he looked like a man possessed.
Right. He had a shot on net. That was probably the most engaged he was in the series.
That's
group.
Right. If he had scored on that shift.
Right.
Then I think that this may have been a different series. But other than that, for the best player, and this isn't a guy who disappears. You know, there's a lot of great players who disappear. Mm-hmm. Crosby has never been one of those guys who disappears, you know, for lengthy periods of time. This wasn't Sidney Crosby in this series.
I mean, he has chances yesterday going up the middle on the pass from Kunitz, I believe. I mean, Malkin really was shut down by Chara. Chara played, I think it was 80, 85, 90% of his shifts against Malkin, and Malkin was fairly invisible. Should have scored at the end of yesterday's game, didn't. But yeah, Drew, I mean, you know, Crosby wasn't necessarily himself in this series. But I think it's in this series that you need to, like the production-wise before that, he was producing at a great clip. So I think what, instead of saying what Crosby didn't do, I think a lot of it has to do with what Boston did do.
Well, let me ask you that. That leads into my next question. What Boston did to Pittsburgh in this series, is that a blueprint that other teams can use going forward?
No, because other teams don't have Boston's mix of skill, speed, size. They don't. So it's, you know, it's a classic thing. We could use the, you know, the Jets could use the Tampa Bay power play format, and nobody can shoot like Stamkos or pass like St. Louis, and it doesn't work.
So it's not a system thing as much as it was the players involved.
Yeah, I really do think not that they don't play their system well, but it's because of the players that they have. Boston, I mean, get to know Bergeron and Marchand, because they're going to be the fourth line center and left winger on Team Canada, as far as I'm concerned.
In the Sochi Olympics up next year.
You could make an argument that four forwards on the Boston Bruins could be on Team Canada. I mean, you could throw in Sagan, you could throw in Lucic, but maybe Lucic won't get there because of his skating. Yeah. Right? But no, you make a good point. I mean, if you're looking for a Conn Smythe winner right now, and, you know, I think it's time to start talking about that, because Boston's in the Stanley Cup Finals. Mm-hmm. I think you're talking Marchand and Bergeron for me. Tuukka Rask has been unbelievable, and Krejci. I always look at, you know, the Conn Smythe and all that, and really, I know it's not the most important thing right now, but it is important when you talk about really who is really, you know, mm-hmm. driving the bus here. And it's not just one or two guys. And Tuukka Rask has been unbelievable, but Brad Marchand and Patrice Bergeron right now are they flat out outplayed Pittsburgh's top players.
That's just it. And I think Marchand, even yesterday's play, let's quickly go over yesterday's goal. It was so interesting. I guess we got to go to location.
Got a couple minutes, though.
Marchand comes down the left wing, an amazing speed, and he curls back. A curl back was a play that was common in the 80s and 90s because the offensive players on the other team weren't back-checking as hard. This is kind of the opposite as far as I could tell in that play. Marchand skates down the left wing, the winning goal yesterday. It's really hard. Pittsburgh's back-checking hard, extra hard because Marchand's so fast, and they overcommit to back-checking. He curls, makes a beautiful pass to McQuaid, and McQuaid puts a top corner. I mean, Marchand came down the left wing in Game 3, in double overtime, makes a beautiful pass, and Bergeron gets his stick to exactly where it needs to be, and the execution is tremendous. The skill level and the effort level of the players on this team, you know, you have to applaud it. And I just think they did a great job, and they deserve to win. To me, they deserve to win more than Pittsburgh deserved to lose. I think that's a story. The storyline is Boston's execution.
Drew, love him or hate him, Brad Marchand has basically put his money where his mouth is. And he's shown up to play here. And, you know, he might be a guy that you hate to play against, but you want him on your team. He's shown us he has a playmaking aspect to his game that I don't think a lot of people realized. And I think he's shown us that he's an all-around terrific hockey player. And I agree with Richie. I think he should absolutely be on Team Canada.
Let's go to break.
At the Olympics.
Yeah, at the Olympics. Let's go to break. When we come back on the other side, I want to talk about the future of the Pittsburgh Penguins, because they have a lot of decisions they have to make. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Yes, Ezra?
I just wanted to throw this out for people listening, because I do think this is interesting. We went back and we looked. I think the point that Richie made in the first segment is a great point here for all those fans and, you know, that are, you know, thinking, well, how did this happen? How did the Bruins beat the Penguins? And, you know, the Bruins are a great team, but this continuity point, I think, is a really good team. The only difference really in the roster from the 2011 team that won the Cup, the Bruins, the team that won the Cup, of course. Thomas Cabrera was on that team, and Mark Recchi. And really, if you think about it, they've replaced Thomas Cabrera with, if you want to say, Torrey Krug or Dougie Hamilton or even Wade Redden. But the point being, five of the six defensemen were on that team. And they've replaced Mark Recchi with Jaromir Jagr. So I think it's a really good point. I mean, this is essentially the same team, if not better. And then you got to throw in Tim Thomas, Tuukka Rask, right? But I think it's a really good point. This organization has continuity, and they have built a team. And the scary thing is, this team's going to be good for a while now, because mm-hmm. it's not a team that's old by any stretch of the imagination. Char's 36, but he's got a few years left in him. And obviously, when they lose him, that'll be a huge blow. But this is a team that was built to win, and it's very similar. So I just thought I'd throw that in. I think it's a good point that Richie brought up before.
Let's shift our focus to the Pittsburgh Penguins. first of all, a lot of talk. I don't see this happening, but there's a lot of talk about the future of Dan Bylsma as the Penguins head coach. Do you think there's any validity into the concept or the idea that he might not belong for the head man job in Pittsburgh?
I think he has to be evaluated, Drew. I mean, he's coming in, I guess he's been there 3.5 years now. He came in halfway through the 2008-09 season,
mm-hmm.
and he took that team from Michel Therrien and took it all the way to the Cup, and they beat the Detroit team that they lost to the year prior.
Right.
The next year he comes in, if I'm getting my years correct, the next year he comes in and they lose to Montreal in the second round. And then the following year, they lose to Philadelphia.
Without Crosby and Malkin.
Last year? No Malkin either?
Were they both? Was it the year before that Malkin tore his ACL?
Might have been. I don't remember.
Okay.
Even so, they're the favorites in both series.
Fine. True.
And they lose last year to the Flyers in the first round. And then this year, they have, I mean, what Vegas believes to be the favorite in the National Hockey League Stanley Cup playoffs. And they lose in 4 games to the Boston Bruins. So you do have to evaluate the job Bylsma's done. He hasn't got this team back to the final when arguably they were the favorite each and every year. And that's something that needs to be examined. I mean, do you remove him as head coach? I don't think you do. I think he's still a very good head coach. But I don't think he gets a free pass here, Drew. I mean, this is a team that shouldn't have lost in the first round. They weren't able to adjust to Philly last year.
Mm-hmm.
Although I like that Philly team, they shouldn't have lost to Montreal for sure the year prior to that.
Right.
And sure, he gets credit for the Stanley Cup. 100% he does. But there's a lot of talent on this team. And he has not been able to harness their discipline at times in terms of the defensive game. And I think that's an issue. I mean, especially last year against Philadelphia. I mean, here it's a whole different story. They couldn't score. And there's certain parts of the team that may have some weaknesses. But overall, talent-wise, this was teams that should have made the Stanley Cup Finals at least once in the past 3 years. At least.
Drew, I think there is a chance that Pittsburgh is looking at their coaching situation and saying there might be an issue here. And, you ask me personally, I do think that Dan Bylsma has failed to get them over the hump. Talk about last year against Philadelphia losing. That was disappointing. The highest scoring team in the NHL, when they score 2 goals in 4 games, you can't help but keep going back to that in this series. I mean, 2 goals in 4 games against, granted, a very good defensive team. But what's probably most concerning for Ray Shiro and Mario Lemieux is that they were completely dominated and didn't seem to have any answers for Boston. Meaning, they just couldn't. It wasn't like Tuukka Rask played out of his mind and Tuukka Rask was the difference. Pittsburgh didn't seem to have any type of scheme or way to get their big guys going. And, you know, that's all, the whole team, really. And if you look at certain things that he did, I personally, and I've told you guys this before, I prefer Mark Eaton over Derek Englund. I'm not a big fan of Derek Englund, and I thought Mark Eaton was good, but Bylsma would put in Englund over Eaton, and I didn't really understand that. Putting Tyler Kennedy in and out of the lineup with Joe Vitale, I think Tyler Kennedy is better than Joe Vitale. I like his game, and he was good. So I look at this, and I'm thinking, like, you know, I question why Bylsma is doing that. And when you get swept, and again, the way they lost and their total lack of any type of answer for Boston, it's got to be concerning. Because when you have the two best players in the NHL, arguably the two best players, at the very least the top 5 players, and they can't get going, that's got to make you wonder, what's going on here? You know, like, why are these guys not, you know, producing at these opportune times?
I missed one season, Drew. You mentioned the season where Crosby and Malkin were injured. That was 2010-11. They lost to Tampa in the first round. I believe they were up 3-1 in that series, were they not?
That was the year that Tampa went to the Cup, or went to the conference finals and lost to Boston. That was Boston's Cup year.
I don't remember if they were up 3-1 that series or not. That's a couple of years ago now. But in any event, it's been second round in 2009-10, second round loss. 2010-11, first round loss. 2011-12, first round loss. 2012-13, a third round lost. And, you know, you say overall, oh, that's successful. But you have to look at the team and the expectations that go along with that team. And as you mentioned, I mean, you know, there hasn't been some answers here. And that's 4 years in a row that the job hasn't necessarily gotten done. And then you look at
Well, hold on. Before you continue that thought, again, you got to mention that Islanders are a good team. They had a lot of trouble with the Islanders.
They did.
We're talking they almost didn't get out of the first round. So, mm-hmm. I mean, you got to factor that in, too, here. This isn't a team that cruised to the third round by any stretch of the imagination.
That's true. And then if they had lost in the first round, I think Bylsma would be gone because that would be three first-round losses in a row for a team that's got to be better than that, regardless of the Crosby-Malkin injuries that one season. But, you know, I don't think you get rid of the coach, but I do think you need to address the defense. And obviously, we haven't talked about goaltending yet, but Vulcan wasn't the problem in this series. You need to address the defense. And what's going to happen? I believe Letang has one more year in his contract.
He does.
They certainly have prospects in the system. We were talking about it prior to the show. Oli Mata, Derek Pouliot. They traded Joe Morrow, but they have the depth to be able to have made that trade.
Dupre is still relatively young.
Simon Dupre.
Yep.
So, I mean, you have guys like that, but the question is, does the timeline mix? Meaning, are those defensemen ready to roll when your guys are at the height of their game?
Well, let's look at their defense. You have Paul Martin's under contract for two more years.
I want to say something. I thought Paul Martin was one of their best defensemen in the playoffs. I really did. Letang, I didn't think was good, especially earlier on in the series. I thought Martin was very solid. And Orpik obviously was injured, and he ended up improving, but it's not a strong group. This isn't the 2009 team, and we've talked about it before with Zibanek, Mahalik, and Hal Gill, and Rob Scuderi. Remember that group. This isn't, and we've talked about that, and you got to think, like just Richie just said, you know, is that where you have to really focus on there?
Yeah, Mahalik came in after those guys to replace them, and then they haven't, and you mentioned, Ezzy, Mahalik was basically replaced this year by Doug Murray, and to me, Mahalik's better.
Yeah, I didn't think Murray was bad, but, I mean, you know, he's a defensive defenseman, but anyways, I just thought I'd throw that in there. I really like the way Martin played.
Well, you have the same sort of, with the exception of Douglas Murray, who's an unrestricted free agent after this season, next year you're going to be bringing back a lot of the same defensemen, trades notwithstanding. Martin's under contract. Orpik is under contract. Letang is under contract. Niskanen is under contract. Dupre and England are both under contract. You look at the year after. You look at the 2014-2015 season.
Yeah.
The only one of those guys who's under contract is Paul Martin. Orpik's a UFA. Letang is a UFA, and that's the big one. Niskanen's a UFA. England's a UFA, less important. But 14-15, both Malkin and Letang are going to be unrestricted free agents.
Some people think that Letang will be on the market this summer because he's going to want more money than they're willing to pay him, and they have some good young defensemen in the system. It's an interesting thing to consider. Also, the question is, and that they come along with each other, Letang's going to be asking for big dollars. Does his game really deserve big money? I mean, he is a dominant offensive defenseman, but he has limitations when it comes to defense, and are they willing to pay for more of a one-sided game rather than a two-sided game, because the money's going to be a big clip. He's going to make probably in excess of $6 million a year.
I think his limitations, Drew, are similar to Tobias Enstrom. I think you have a situation where you have, like Richie said, a guy that people just don't realize how good of a skater Letang is, I don't think. Well, I think people do, but maybe he's one of the best skaters, like a Scott Niedermeyer. But defensively, again, is not one of the best defensemen in the NHL. And when you're asking for $6 million a year, right? So you raise a good point. You're going to have Derek Pouliot and Oli Mata coming through the system, both first-rounders. Or maybe Mata was a second-rounder. I forget. But Pouliot was a high first-rounder last year.
Is there any, in your mind, if it's a question of Malkin, of re-signing either Malkin or Letang, is there any question in your mind at all?
No.
It's Malkin 100% in your books?
Yeah.
You know when we talk about certain guys that you can't afford not to sign? Richie Getzlaff Perry? You're not going to get any player better than that back, right? So you have to sign those guys.
Up the middle, yeah, exactly right. Now, I mean, you have obviously Ginlev UFA this year, Morrow UFA this year, and
Cook, Dupuy, Craig Adams. I mean, Craig Adams obviously not as important, but he's one of the depth guys.
Yeah.
But Dupuy had a terrific year. Yeah. He's an unrestricted free agent. Cook seems to only work in Pittsburgh.
Dupuy makes the most sense there because of his chemistry with Crosby, but Dupuy may want to go for that big deal before he retires. And, you know, I mean, you can't blame the guy necessarily. We'll talk about Sergei Gonchar later about big deals before you retire. But that idea is, you know, you mentioned Iginla and Morrow. I mean, do they even want Morrow is a question. And in terms of Iginla, And what does he want? Does he want to head back to the West Coast?
Yeah. Did he go east just to make his cup run? And it obviously didn't work.
Picked the wrong team.
Yeah, it looks like he did pick the wrong team. Anyways, let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to shift our attention over to the Western Conference. And, of course, more on the Eastern Conference later on in the show.
Remus here yet?
Not yet. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca here. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and www.illegalcurve.com. Talking about the Bruins' dismantling of the Pittsburgh Penguins. The first round, obviously, or the Eastern Conference Finals, obviously, ended last night with that 4-0 sweep. The Stanley Cup Finals will either begin Wednesday night or next Saturday, depending on what happens tonight between the Kings and the Blackhawks. If the Blackhawks win tonight, then the Cup Final will go Wednesday in Chicago, the Blackhawks and the Bruins for the first time. If it goes longer than tonight, it'll start next Saturday, either in Chicago or Boston, depending on who wins.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Let's welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. He's the voice of the Boston Bruins on the New England Sports Network, Jack Edwards. Jack, good afternoon. The Boston Bruins back into the Stanley Cup Final. In any way, shape, or form, did you think it would be a four-game sweep?
Are you kidding me? I picked Pittsburgh to win the series. Seriously, I did. I picked Pittsburgh to win the series. And in fact, truth be told, I picked the Rangers to win because the Bruins were having to play all those young defensemen. So I think we probably ought to tip our cap to Claude Julien because he's gotten everybody on the same page and in a way that, I mean, the only thing you can really compare this defensive surge to is the way they took on Vancouver in 2011 and held the Canucks, who were the high-flying offense, to 8 goals in 7 games. But to hold Crosby, Malkin, Neal, Kinla, Kunitz, you can go right down the list, the 2 goals in 4 games, that's just off the scale, huh?
Jack, you mentioned Claude Julien in your response there. You know, is it time that Claude Julien gets more credit than he's been getting for all of these years, even though he's had, you know, a relative run of success in Boston?
How is this guy not in the discussion to be the head coach for Team Canada next year? Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. If you play great defense, you're going to have a chance to win every single night. And we were talking to Cam Neely yesterday just before the game, and he said the reason for the defensive philosophy that it is just as important to deny a scoring opportunity as to create one, mm-hmm. is that if you play really good defense every single game, every single day, even if you're in a low-scoring game, you will give yourself a chance to win. And sure enough, you know, that's what he said before the game. And there they are in the third period, and it's still 0-0, and McQuaid ramps one up off of a Ginla's stick, and it goes top corner, and they hang on and win 1-0. I mean, that's exactly how it's supposed to play out. Now, granted, it's hard to take an all-star team and have them all understand Claude's system and execute it within a week, but, it's hard to frame a Team Canada without Claude at least being on the staff. The guy is a brilliant coach.
We talked to you about this before, Jack. Team Canada, I mean, to me, Team Canada, fourth line, if not higher, fourth line left wing and center is going to be Patrice Bergeron and Brad Marchand. And I'm not so sure there's much debate as there had been before this playoff run.
Yeah, and the only thing that scares you about Marchand, and, in Boston we all love him because, he's such a nut. I mean, he's such an interesting personality. But, yeah, clearly he's a 1-29er. The Bruins love him, and 29 other teams aren't quite so affectionate. In a one-game situation, which you run into in the Olympics, where you got knockout games, Marchand occasionally loses his mind and takes the dumb penalty. And he got away with it in this series because the Bruins' penalty kill was phenomenal, but he took 2 penalties that were really ill-advised. And I think if there's one thing that's standing between Brad Marchand and really getting that top echelon look on Team Canada, it's that people think he might not be totally reliable under pressure, and he might take a penalty that could put the whole national team in peril.
Jack, we were talking about this before you came on, the continuity of the Boston Bruins, and we were going over the roster, and really the only difference between the 2011 Cup winners and this team is Michael Ryder, Mark Recchi, Thomas Caberle. You replace them with Jager, and then you throw in some defensemen, Torrey Krug, Dougie Hamilton. Is it possible, in your opinion, that this team's actually better than that 2011 team?
Well, right now it is, because if you compare the conference final performance of the Bruins in this series just concluded to the conference final performance of the Bruins against Tampa Bay when they blew a three-goal lead, gave up five goals, I think, twice during that series, those are two completely different animals. The thing about this team, though, was that it clearly was looking a little long in the tooth and a little bit stale until, by happenstance, Seidenberg, Ferentz, and Wade Redden all go down in rapid-fire fashion, and they had to call up Matt Bartkowski and Torrey Krug from the Calder Trophy play, the Calder Cup, excuse me, playoffs in the AHL, and the injection of those two young defensemen, Bartkowski and Krug, actually changed the energy level in the entire team. It's a bizarre situation because it was looking as if the Bruins were going to have to make substantial moves in the offseason to inject some youth and energy and puck movement into this team, and only because of injury they ended up finding it in their own system. And it's just funny the way things work out sometimes.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by the voice of the Boston Bruins on the New England Sports Network, Jack Edwards.
Jack, I think it was Joe Haggerty tweeted out that Evgeny Malkin played 89% of his shifts against Zdeno Chara. Just how incredible is Zdeno Chara, and how incredible was he in this series?
I'll tell you something. He's a first ballot Hall of Famer. He is, without a doubt, one of the greatest shutdown defensemen of all time. He plays in an era in which defensemen are not allowed to clutch, grab, and mug forwards as they were before the first lockout in 04-05, or maybe the second if you're keeping track that far back. you know, he's a violent and nasty defenseman, and he knows what the limits are. And it's amazing how we have come to take him for granted. The guy has some flaws in his game, there is no doubt. He's a little bit slow moving the puck when he's on the power play. He is not blessed with a whole lot of fast twitch muscles, but he is, by consensus, the toughest player to play against in the National Hockey League, and I don't think you'll find either Evgeny Malkin or Sidney Crosby telling you otherwise this morning.
Jack, you look at the Bruins roster, and if I told you that Tyler Seguin has 4 points through 16 games in the playoffs, you think, well, it's unlikely they would have played 16 games if you only had 4 points. Is it crucial for the Bruins to win the Cup that they get Seguin going? Or if he turns it on, is it just, you know, a bonus at this point?
I think both could be right. They're going to need some more layers of scoring. And Seguin, with what he has to offer, has got to find a way to contribute to that and to produce. It's not just about playing the right way. And we saw him more physically involved again last night, and that's good. You know, facing 50-50s instead of backing off from them, and sometimes actually backing into them as he was earlier in the playoffs. But Tyler's a guy who has got to find a way either to put the puck in the goal or to help somebody else put the puck in the goal. He has not developed the way they thought he was going to develop. He's below the curve right now, and he's not contributing the way he was supposed to and the way they were hoping he could. To me, it just looks like a toughness situation. It just looks like he's afraid to get his nose broken. And, you know, it's easy for me to say sitting, you know, 150 feet out of harm's way, but that's playoff hockey. And if you're going to be at the very highest level, you have to have that beautiful recklessness that Patrick Kane has. You know, Kane's about the same size as Seguin, but we never see him backing off, flying through a seam, and about to get his head taken off by a guy who's a foot taller than he is.
Jack, we got to talk to you about Nathan Horton, and hopefully I'm not putting you on the spot here, but he is a UFA, as you know, and he's been unbelievable, 17 points. He's been an absolute force up the middle, but can you maybe share with us what the latest is? Is it a foregone conclusion that he's gone, or has this maybe changed things, and is it a chance that Peter Chiarelli signs him in the summer?
Well, on what was the end of the season? April 27th, was it? I would have said it's a foregone conclusion that he's gone. And now I would say that the Bruins are looking at the Lucic-Krejci-Horton line the way they once looked at Hodge, and Esposito and Wayne Cashman, that those three guys go together. When Lucic, who is a natural leader, is fit, which he finally was with about a week to go in the regular season, there aren't many people who can stop him from doing what he wants to do. We saw Derek Englund really do a noble job for Pittsburgh. He really put his body in the way a whole lot. And, you know, for a guy who's generally a third pair defenseman in terms of skill, I was really impressed with Englund's effort. But, you know, nobody else could even slow Lucic down. Horton is not a natural leader by personality. He's got a tremendous, strong body, but he's not the kind of guy who says, hop on my back and I'll carry you. So when Lucic leads, Horton follows. Lucic's strong play emboldens Horton, and that gives room to Krejci, which makes all three of them work so well together. So, yeah, I think it's a very legitimate point that Horton was probably gone at the end of the regular season, but now people are looking at the situation and saying, how can we live without this kind of production in the playoffs? The Bruins have never lost a playoff series in which Nathan Horton has appeared. If he has been healthy at the start of the series, the Bruins have won the series. There's a pretty good connection there, and you've got a pretty broad spectrum of examples from which to draw. So I would not be at all surprised if the Bruins finally use the Mark Savard long-term injury reserve allowance of $4 million to go use Savard's cap exception above the set cap and use it to keep Horton.
Horton was another great acquisition by Peter Chiarelli. He's done just a tremendous job there. Jack, final question. Now, we don't want to overlook Tukarask, who's obviously been unbelievable, but final question looking forward. If the Bruins have their preference, is it the Blackhawks or Kings that they face in the final?
You know, I look at both of those teams, and I see a long, brutal series. I don't know if the Bruins match up better against either one of those teams. The Kings probably have a more congruent style to the Bruins. It's a little bit of a shorter game, maybe, and a more physical game, which is kind of how Boston plays it. The thing that's so impressive about Chicago is that when a rebound comes off of Corey Crawford's pads and a defenseman has it for the Blackhawks, his first look is to the attacking blue line. Yeah. And that kind of vertical game that Joel Quenneville introduced a few years back has really changed the way you have to look at that team. The Bruins can have problems if teams can generate a ton of speed. And so I guess if you force me to pick one, I guess the Bruins would probably rather play L.A., but it sure looks as if they're going to play Chicago. And, of course, as everybody now knows, it would be the first time ever that these two original six teams would play in a Stanley Cup final.
It would be an incredible final. Jack Edwards, you're the voice of the Eastern Conference champions. I'm sure that sounds good. One thing left, that's the Cup. Thanks very much for joining us on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show this afternoon.
And again, it's the greatest name of a hockey show anywhere in North America, and I hope we talk during the final, fellas.
I'm sure we will, Jack. Take care.
Thanks.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. About 10 or so minutes before the top of the hour. Big thank you to Jack Edwards, the voice of the Boston Bruins.
He's great.
He is great. He's bringing, you know,
Timmy is also great for playing the Strokes. That was a special request.
There you go.
Love the Strokes.
Everybody's great. You know, Jack gets accused of being a homer when he broadcasts. You know what? Doesn't bother me the way he brings a lot of passion to the game, so I got no problems with the way he calls a Bruins game. You know, why can't he cheer for them?
He's unbelievable. He's one of the best play-by-play guys in the business.
Great
professional.
Guest, yeah.
We've met him a couple times at the MTS Center. One of our best guests, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely, and you'll probably hear from him as the finals go on. I would not be surprised if he made another return to this show next Saturday. You know, either to preview the Cup Finals or to, you know, there'll be a couple games in at that point in time.
Well, it's funny, Richie asked Jack Edwards who they want to play. And you got to think that they want Chicago and L.A. to beat each other up a little bit.
They probably want them, they want that series going longer than ending tonight. You know, they want that series going seven and having to fly back across the country and everything else a couple more times. Let's talk about that series. 3-1. Blackhawks lead the Kings with Game 5 tonight. You know, how surprised were you that the Blackhawks were able to win Game 4 without Duncan Keith in the lineup?
A little bit surprising, Drew, but I mean, also, no Mike Richards is a huge loss for L.A. and the Kings.
50-50 chance. Richard skated this morning. 50-50 chance that he's going to be in the lineup tonight. I'd be surprised.
Surprised if he's in or out.
He's a tough guy. I'd be surprised if he's out, actually.
Really? He's got a concussion.
He's pretty tough. I'm not saying he should play, but I'm saying I would expect him to play, just based on Mike Richards. But, you know, surprising, Drew, that the Kings, I mean, it's like, you know, probably a weak goal by Quick, and it's these one goal games with this team, and they play a very tight system. It's surprising, but Duncan Keith's a great defenseman. The Hawks have so much firepower, though, they can make up, you know, Duncan Keith for a long period of time. Without him, they'd have trouble, but for one game, I'm not completely shocked. Chicago looks just like the team that's is more fresh and is ramped up, ready to go to the next round. I think LA looks like a tired team based on, I guess, last year's play. And the continuity, you know, we talk about continuity with the Boston Bruins. There is similar continuity with the LA Kings. But if you remember, last year the Boston Bruins lost in the first round, and now they've bounced back. So it is tough with the way both teams, Boston and LA, play to go 2 years in a row.
Sure. I mean, even though Chicago's really only played one extra game than the Kings, if you actually look at it, they won in five, the Kings won in six.
Yeah.
The Kings, the six games that the Kings played were a lot tougher than the five games the Blackhawks played in the first round, and of course both played seven in the second round.
But guys, you know, kudos to Sheldon Brookbank, a good Saskatchewan boy, comes in for Duncan Keith, does a pretty good job. I mean, he's coming in, under pretty bad circumstances. And, you know, he's more of a defensive defenseman, a depth guy for the Chicago Blackhawks. But he comes in and plays pretty well. I think they held the LA Kings to, 21 shots in LA's building. And, you know, you can't not talk about this series without talking about Brian Bickle.
Mm-hmm.
Gets another goal. On Patrick Kane's goal, Bickle should have got credit for that. Kane, you know, came behind.
I made a career of scoring that kind of goal in hockey.
Yeah, you know what they call that? They call that the tap in goal. But
the thievery.
Brian Bickle has been unbelievable because Taves and Kane have, you know, they've just been okay. Kane being better than Taves, I think, in this series. But you can't talk about L.A. without talking about Dustin Brown, the captain. Where has he been? No points in the series. Mm-hmm. 4 points in 17 games. You talk about Crosby and what was going on with him in that series. Dustin Brown has to be injured, or there has to be something going on with him. Because I thought that if Jonathan Quick didn't win the Conn Smythe for MVP last year, it should have been Dustin Brown. And he's still playing every game, but something's up with him. Because a guy like him, no points, 4 games, 3 points, pardon me, 4 points in 17 playoff games. You know, the captain of your team, that's just not good enough.
I think part of that's the lack of Andrei Kopitar production. I think also Dustin Brown, as he was a warrior, plays really hard, he's a big hitter, but he's not a just natural talent. Like, he's not a guy who can just go and pop 40. And so sometimes guys like him are more 20 to 25 goal scorers. They go cold for periods of time, and this happens to be the time that he's gotten cold. Kopitar, to me, is more disconcerting if you're a Los Angeles fan, because he's a 70 to 80 point guy, big guy, and generally a dominant guy, and hasn't been able to get going. Daryl Sutter made mention of having to get him the puck more often, but I think a lot of that is on Andrei Kopitar, because he's got to take initiative, he's got to get involved, he's got to go get the puck. And I think that Sutter's used different mechanisms to try and motivate him, and for whatever reason, he hasn't been able to match last year's production. So, I mean, for LA to have come this far and not have production from really at all from Kopitar and Brown, and I realize
it's catching up to them.
Kane and Taves have been an issue, but LA LA requires their better players to score, because LA's depth guys or big guys who control the puck down low but don't contribute much offense. And as you mentioned, Bickle. Well, Chicago's depth guys are more the skill speed guys. So LA relies more so on their top guys to produce than does Chicago, and you're seeing that, and that's one of the reasons why this series is 3-1.
If you're LA, you're looking at it, I mean, even though Kopitar and Brown are playing, they're not playing well. Mm-hmm. Richards hasn't been playing, so he's out of the lineup. So really, you're three of your better players are not contributing like they should. I mean, really, is that the long and the short of the series so far?
In the first two rounds against the St. Louis Blues and the San Jose Sharks, it was the Mike Richards, Jeff Carter, Dustin Penner line that was getting most of the goals. And you throw in some other guys that were getting some goals, but that was their better line, because Brown and Kopitar, as Richie said, I guess I said too, haven't been good all playoffs. And yeah, sure, they went up against Pietrangelo and Shattenkirk and Bomeister, and then they went up against San Jose. But I think that when you look at this team, they're not as deep as maybe we gave them credit for. I still think their defense is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Robin Regier has been a great addition. Signed him to a two-year deal. I know he's taking flack for the way he's played in this series, but I still think Robin Regier is a great defensive defenseman, physical. But I really think that you compare the LA Kings to the Boston Bruins, if you look at their depth, and it's not really an argument. I don't think a lot of people would put LA's forward group. I'm just talking about forwards on the topic of Brown and Kopitar. You put up Boston's forward group against LA's forward group, I don't think you have a good argument. Chicago, on the other hand, I think you can make an argument that they're pretty equal.
You know, at the trade deadline, or when the trade deadline came and went, I think, and you correct me if I'm wrong, we sort of said we thought Chicago should have upgraded a little bit more, should have done a little bit more at the trade deadline. Can you make the argument that the most impactful trade deadline acquisition this year has been Michael Hanzus for Chicago?
And we said they needed two things. We said they needed a center who could win the draws, and that's exactly what Hanzus is.
Yep.
And we said, you know, probably use one more defenseman for depth-wise, and they haven't had any injuries, and Brookbank played yesterday, but, I mean, overall, they haven't had any injuries. Which is rare, like in Boston, on the other hand. So I'll stand by that. But in terms of Hanzus, yeah, he's been a really nice addition, and he's probably...
He's got 9 points, Richie.
Yeah, and he's produced way more than they anticipated. And I think that's a product of his veteran experience. I think it's also a product of playing with really skilled players.
Well, of course. But, yeah. I mean, they brought him in to play with skilled players.
Well, they brought him in, I thought, to play fourth line, and they've ended up putting him to the second line.
Because he's earned it.
Yeah, and because they have so much depth and they prefer to play their guys like Sharp and Kane on the wings as opposed to at center, where they have in the past. I think another reason is Hanzus' lack of skating ability at this point in his career. Not that he ever carved it up great, but at this point in his career is able to be masked by the fact that he plays on an extremely fast team and they're able to support him really well. So that was a nice addition by Stan Bowman.
It's pretty funny because he was in L.A. earlier in his career. With the LA organization, but he's been a fantastic acquisition. Johnny Oduya has been great. He was an acquisition at last year's trade deadline.
He had some trouble in the Detroit series. He made that great pass on the Hossa goal, the game-winning goal in Game 5.
Yep. He's been very good for them.
Yeah. How much money has Brian Bickell earned for himself this offseason or this playoff run?
I've heard as high as $5 million a year, which is ridiculous. You got to think it's at least three. I mean, and he's making the league minimum $600,000 right now, or around the league minimum, but 8 goals. I was calling him the new John Drews.
Yeah, I saw that.
I don't want to toot my own horn, but a certain guy on the NHL Midweek Show, if you remember, 3 things I learned this week. One of them was about Brian Bickell and how he was going to perform in the playoffs. Hopefully, we can get that up.
Yeah, let's get that up.
I did predict Brian Bickell was going to come through big for the Blackhawks. I do remember that.
Can we find Karnak's clip?
So I'm just saying, I'm a little bit, you can call me clairvoyant.
Yeah, Ezzy the Magnificent as opposed to Karnak the Magnificent? Yeah. Is that what we're going to do?
You can see it, though. I mean, the guy's got 20 goals in the NHL before, around 20 goals. I mean, the guy's got a scoring touch.
Big, mean, and goes to the net on a team that is more of a skilled team on the periphery.
Richie, I don't think the Hawks will re-sign him, though. I think it'll be too much. I think they'll end up going to another team, though.
Does the series end tonight?
I mean, all the signs point to the series ending tonight, and the question is, can Sutter get these guys going? LA needs, it's like the Corey Perry situation in Anaheim. I mean, if they're going to go out tonight, if they're going to go out and win tonight, they need the guys who've struggled all playoffs to step up big time. And if not, they probably are down because they've been outplayed. And so the trend is indicating that they're going to lose, and I would have a hard time bidding against it.
And then when, you know, it's amazing, last Saturday we thought, you know, both of these series would go 6 or 7 games, be real long wars.
Both wrong. I thought both would go 7, yeah.
Yeah, and then you're going to, and if Chicago wins tonight, you're going to have 1 series ending in 4, 1 series ending in 5, and I don't think very many people would have predicted that happening.
Although this time in June, probably a good idea.
Yeah, well, the season's going long enough as is. Anyways, let's go to break. When we come back, we're going to focus our attention to Blake Wheeler and his restricted free agent status for the Winnipeg Jets. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. 1 hour down, 2 hours to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Listen online at tsn1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, facebook.com/Illegal Curve, and the website is www.illegalcurve.com.
This segment of the show is brought to you by the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba. The CGA Association of Manitoba is the largest, fastest-growing, and most diverse accounting body in the province. Did you know that CGAs are among the top 5% of income earners in Canada? For more information, contact the CGA Association of Manitoba at cga-manitoba.org or give them a call at 204-477-1256. The CGA Association of Manitoba, we see more than numbers.
Drew, we have some breaking news here at the TSN 1290 studios on Pembina Highway.
What's that, is it?
The vending machines here in the lunchroom have been unplugged. I can't get a drink.
Troy Westwood must be responsible for that.
I mean, Troy likes his Diet Pepsi. Richie likes his Diet Pepsi. Went to go get Richie and myself a Diet Pepsi. It moved the vending machines out of the lunchroom. We got nothing here.
Timmy's going to try for us.
Right, what am I supposed to drink? Tap water?
You could. There's a Culligan machine around the corner.
I don't want to drink water. Who drinks water?
I'm drinking water right now.
So am I.
It's actually pretty healthy. I don't like water.
Okay. Good to know. I'm sure the water industry is taking note of that.
It's got to have carbonation in there. It's got to have some sugar, some glucose, fructose, Drew.
As we've been doing for the past couple of weeks, we've been looking at some of the Winnipeg Jets' upcoming restricted free agents and evaluating their worth and how we see their contract negotiations play out. 2 weeks ago, we did Brian Little. Last week, we did Zach Bogosian. Today, let's do Blake Wheeler. Blake Wheeler, of course, is a right winger for the Winnipeg Jets. He is a restricted free agent. My first question to both of you, in your mind, has Blake Wheeler shown you enough these past 2 years to be declared a clear-cut first-line right winger?
I think so. I think if anybody's a clear-cut top-liner on the NHL Jets, it's probably Blake Wheeler and Kane. And Andrew Ladd's proven that for this team, he's a first-liner. But Blake Wheeler has the offensive skills, and on a pretty consistent basis this year.
We have breaking news.
We do have drinks.
Machines, not only do they work, but they seem very cold and plugged in.
Go on about Blake Wheeler.
I guess I don't know. Timmy, what did you do? Maybe you get Timmy on the mic here. I'm not sure what happened there, but...
Well, I mean, the drinks were there. I don't know why you thought they were unplugged, but... It was in a different room.
Yeah, it was in a different room, right?
Yes, they moved it to the storage
room. He's like the electric car. We plugged him in for the first hour of the show, and now we need to plug him in again because he's not working.
The question is, though, who killed the electric car?
That's a documentary that you can watch at your own spare time if you like it.
This isn't the Nature Channel.
Blake Wheeler, in terms of his first-line right winger, I think that's a really interesting question. I think that could take up the hour that we're going to break down his contract over because... there are times that Blake Wheeler, you would see him play, and he's completely invisible. Mm-hmm. There are times where
Not many times, though, this year.
No, not many, and I like his game, but there are times where he's completely dominant. And to me, he's kind of one of those guys where the first 5 minutes of the game, whether he's going to be into it or not. I think he engages quickly, goes to the net when he's playing his best, drives to the net either from the right or left side, skating down the wing. So his production-wise, I think, and we're going to talk about it in terms of his contract, right wingers in the past couple of years. I mean, if you're looking at, sometimes people, there's two different perspectives. One is he a first-line National Hockey League right winger? And the other question is he a first-line National Hockey League right winger on a top team? Because there's two different things. If you look at the first-line National Hockey League right winger, are there 30 right wingers in the league that are better than Blake Wheeler? Likely not.
Right. And the numbers bear that out.
Yeah, and then the questions are, for example, if you're looking at the right wingers, In the playoffs, on the top teams, you look at Boston, and they have, Horton. Jagr's playing right wing. Sagan's playing right wing. You look at L.A. and Justin Williams and Jeff Carter. And Chicago's got a boatload of talent. We could go all the way down their wing. And who you're looking at the other side, you're looking at Pittsburgh, and you're looking at Jerome McGinley. And now Dupuis is better than Dupuis. But so that's what that's the consideration there is he that in that level? It's a good question. I mean, is he Jeff Carter? No, I don't think he's Jeff Carter, but he's better than a couple of those guys, and I think he's a first line. I think he's proven. I looked at him as a top six guy, and the question was, is he second line or first line? He's proven to be more first line than second line, I think, over the course of the last two seasons in Winnipeg.
Well, let's talk about the numbers. Goals, assists, points. I mean, if you look at the last lockout shortened year, the one that just finished, he's fifth among NHL right wingers with 19 goals. Mm-hmm. He's 11th among NHL right wingers with 22 assists, and he's 8th
among NHL right-wingers with 41 points.
This past year, yep.
This past year. Go back 2 years ago, his first year in Winnipeg, where he really came off that really slow start. 45th among NHL right-wingers with only 17 goals. So that was a, you know, the goal scoring was a problem 2 years ago.
Still more a passer than a goal.
Still more a passer, but his passing last year, 2 years ago, pardon me, fifth in the NHL in assists among right-wingers with 47 assists.
Yep.
So his playmaking skills as a passer, as a distributor, are really something that, you know, it puts him in the upper echelon of right-wing talent, I would say, just looking at his passing skills.
Right, and you don't want to just look at numbers.
Right.
But as far as offensive production goes, I think that these numbers, Blake Wheeler's numbers in his first 2 years as a Jet, prove that he is a first-line right-winger. When you're top five 1 year in assists and then top five 1 year in goals for right-wingers, I think that right there proves that you're a number one line right winger as far as offensive production goes. And Blake Wheeler also has limitations in his game. He's not your prototypical power forward. I've told this to Richie many times before. Blake Wheeler's game, and because he's 6'5", he reminds me a lot of Keith Primo. And he's not as physical as Keith Primo, and I don't think he's as good as Keith Primo. If you remember back in 2004 when the Lightning won the Cup, remember how good Keith Primo was for the Flyers? Mm-hmm. People were talking about him maybe getting the Conn Smythe, even though he didn't get to the finals. But to me, he's like a Keith Primo. And the way he can go down the wing and use his size and cut in, he's got tons of offensive talent. That's why he was drafted fourth overall by the Coyotes. But I think these numbers prove that he is. I mean, compare him. Yeah, sure, he's not the best right-winger in the NHL, but I think you can make a strong argument that he's a top-10 right-winger in the NHL.
He's an average of 11th overall in points for right-wingers, 11th overall among right-wingers in points over the past two seasons. And I think if you're looking at determining whether or not he's a top-line right-winger, I mean, I think Matt Keeter, his agent, has a pretty strong argument that he is. So I think when if you're making that determination, I don't think there's much of an argument. I mean, if you're going to say he's a second-line right-winger, then you really have to put forth enough evidence that he's in the 30 to 60 range. And I think people sometimes don't realize either that right-wingers are, you know, you look at the right-wingers in top production in the National Hockey League, it's not as deep as you might think. Hold on a second. Somebody just walked into the studio.
Yeah, we'll deal with Remus's arrival an hour and 10 minutes into the show, a little bit later on, maybe in the last hour of the show.
Guys, I love how Remus, you know, comes in an hour and 10 minutes late, drops a thing of Timbits, and then just leaves.
Well, that's fine. He brought Timbits. He can leave altogether as far as I'm concerned. He brought the donuts. I'm happy about that. You know, looking at Wheeler, you know, how much, I mean, you look at his power play. You know, he had 19 goals this past year. Only two of them are on the power play.
Yep.
So he's had some success 5-on-5. Mm-hmm. Does that speak a lot to, you know, future, you know, a future, a positive future for Blake Wheeler?
You know, do you have some concern about the power play production? Sure, but overall, I think that his even strength production is really something to build on, for sure. And it's hard to produce at even strength, and if he can do that, and his combinations, as you mentioned, of size and speed certainly allows him, affords him the opportunity to create some offense 5-on-5, and it's a good thing.
I think if you look at, too, who he's playing with, Brian Little, we've talked about, is probably a second-line center on most teams, maybe even a third-line center.
Right.
You put Blake Wheeler back on the team that he came from and put him with David Krejci or Patrice Bergeron.
That was going to be
you put him with Jonathan Tate. I mean,
yeah.
I think he gets 80, 90 points.
That was going to be one of my next questions is, does he have further room for improvement? Is he hit his ceiling or does he still have room to grow?
I mean, I think a guy of his age is probably going to be 64 points 2 years ago, last season. You know, you're looking at probably a 70-point guy max, but those don't come around too often, so.
So it's a guy that's probably worth re-signing.
Yeah, probably.
We'll talk about it. The next segment, we'll talk about the comparables to Blake Wheeler that have already been signed to contracts in the NHL. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290. Back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Yes, Ezra? Or as you're now known, strawberries.
Yeah.
And cream.
Yeah. I
the whole night was a blur? Is that what happened?
Yeah, last night was a bit of a blur with us.
Yeah.
I don't know how I got home. I'm happy that I have my pants and my shoes. But, guys, we got to give a special birthday shout-out to my
Heartsy
roommate.
Yes.
Hart Jacob. as he's affectionately known, Hartsy.
Mm-hmm.
Big happy birthday to him. He's 31 years old today. We're going to be celebrating later tonight.
Yes.
One of our good friends. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, you beat me to that one. I was going to do that one as well. Anyways, continuing on with Blake Wheeler and the analysis of his RFA situation. Richie, in the article that you wrote about this for IllegalCurve.com, which... Remus, now that he's here, can tweet out on our Twitter feed, at Illegal Curve. You had four players you thought are statistical comparables to Blake Wheeler.
Mm-hmm.
The four of them are Jakub Voracek.
Right wingers,
yes. These are all right wingers. Jakub Voracek of the Flyers, Wayne Simmonds of the Flyers, P.A. Parenteau, formerly of the Islanders, went to the Avalanche as an unrestricted free agent, and Teddy Purcell of the Tampa Bay Lightning. Those are the four players that you declared are statistical comparables mm-hmm. to Blake Wheeler. You know, rank those five players for me, including Wheeler. Like, which one of those five is the best right winger of the five?
That's a good question. I would probably... I think the debate is probably amongst Voracek, Simmonds, and Wheeler, with maybe a little bit step below Parenteau and Purcell. I mean, Voracek, at his age and his passing ability, I mean, he's a great passer. Simmonds can do a lot of stuff. I think Voracek probably, if I had to pick one and be number one, probably Wheeler 2, Simmonds 3, Parenteau 4, and Purcell 5, but all quality players.
The difference, of course, being Voracek is only 22 years old. So
he's such a supreme talent. I just love his game. I've always loved his game. He'll engage. He's a great passer.
But
good vision.
My point was he's in a slightly different situation than Wheeler mm-hmm. in that he was an RFA, but he was not an arbitration eligible RFA when he signed his last contract.
No, he was.
He was arbitration
yep.
eligible.
Okay. Yeah, he had already played 4 years.
Pardon me. I apologize in that case. So he is in the same boat as Blake Wheeler.
Every single contract signed what we're comparing to was already arbitration eligible.
Okay. So these are all guys who were, as opposed to last week when we compared Doughty and Bogosian, and Doughty wasn't arbitration eligible at that point in time. So you got Wheeler. He's 26 years old. You know, all these guys, you know, Voracek signed a 4-year deal. Parenteau signed a 4-year deal. Teddy Purcell signed a 3-year deal. And then Wayne Simmonds signed a 6-year deal. Wayne Simmonds was acquired for Mike Richards from Los Angeles. And Voracek was acquired from Columbus for Jeff Carter. Yeah. That was when they shook up the lineup there. You know, which one of those guys is Blake Wheeler best compared to, in your opinion?
That's another good question. In terms of a style of play, I'm not so sure Wheeler's probably more like Simmonds than Voracek. You know, you're talking about right-handed shots as opposed to left-handed shot with Voracek. You're talking about Wayne Simmonds, a little bit more physical than Wheeler, but Wheeler's, you know, he'll engage in contact too. He won't shy away from it. He sometimes loses his temper. I think they're more similar in terms of their games. I think Wheeler probably scores more off the rush than maybe any of the guys. But I think Simmonds would be the more the comparable player there.
And again, Richie should mention that these were picked more so for their age, contract status,
100%.
Not guys that are just comparable to Blake Wheeler in playing style. Because everyone looks at a guy like Blake Wheeler, and because he's 6'5", and he said this when the Thrashers moved to Winnipeg, he said that, you know, I guess I'm a power forward type, but he's not really a power forward type. Just because you're a big guy doesn't mean you're power forward, meaning that he's not a guy that dumps the puck in the corner and hits guys like, say, a Milan Lucic.
Right.
Like, Milan Lucic mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is like a Cam Neely. He's a power forward. Power forward doesn't just mean you're a big guy. It means your style of play is kind of like a physical grinding style. And as far as Blake Wheeler goes, he's a scorer. And so in the sense of these four players, I would compare him to even a more of a Parenteau or a Purcell, because Voracek and Simmonds on Philly, they play more of that kind of physical style. Like a guy like Simmonds, he'll drop the gloves. And that's not to say that Blake Wheeler doesn't lay any body checks. Right. Just not his game. I mean, his game is using his speed down the wing, and he's a playmaker. But I do think that I would probably say that, you know, he's more like a Parenteau or Purcell, but the problem with that is he's more of a playmaker, so...
What's the biggest con to Blake Wheeler's game? Is it that he disappears? That he has the potential to disappear or just not be there consistently?
Sometimes. I think he's probably improved on that a little bit. I think also if you watch enough players as closely as we watch Wheeler, you probably see the same thing. So I think that's one of the things. I think, if anything, sometimes he'll overhandle for that split second and not make quick decisions. I think when he's playing well, he's making quicker decisions and he's driving to the net as opposed to overthinking it. You'd like to see a little bit more production on the power play. Because I think his... See, the problem with Wheeler is we talked about off the rush. Wheeler creates off the rush, and I think when he's skating with the puck, he makes the quicker decisions, and I think that speaks to it, because when you talk about the power play, you have a little more time. I think when he has more time, that doesn't suit him well.
I agree.
I think he likes to be pressured, and he likes to be able to make decisions quickly. I think that's when he succeeds.
Yeah, for me, there aren't a lot of flaws in Blake Wheeler's game. I really like his game, and I do think he is a number one right winger, not just on the Jets, but on any team. I do think, and he, I think he will be on Team USA at the Olympics as well. But for me, it is the power play. He gets top power play time, and as we know, especially in this market, the Jets' power play lacks a lot, and a lot of guys haven't been producing on the power play. Look at Kane, a lot of guys. But Blake Wheeler's getting top power play time, and Richie mentioned, you know, he doesn't really like to have the puck on a stick for too long type of thing on the power play. But, yeah, for me, for him to take the next level, you know, you're talking about 64 points. Can he go to 75, 80 points? Well, there you go. If he starts putting the puck in the net a little bit more on the power play, there's your 15 points, right? So, but there aren't a lot of flaws to his game, because when you're talking about guys that can combine his size and skill, skating ability, there aren't a lot of guys. I keep coming back to that Keith Primeau comparison, and to me, I haven't seen a big guy move like that since a Keith Primeau.
Do you have any fear that he's one-dimensional? Is he responsible enough in his own zone? Can they rely on him enough in his own zone, or is it just, you know, the nitpicking at that point?
He's fine that way. I mean,
you know, he got 20 seconds of shorthanded ice time per game in this last year.
He's a top line. He's their top line right winger. They need to score goals. They can worry about other guys. They can sign a defensively responsible third liner to kill penalties.
That settles that.
no need for further argument.
Yeah,
case closed. Richie has spoken.
The lawyer. Well, they need to do that, though. I mean, this is one thing Kevin Cheveldayoff needs to do this offseason, is address the penalty killing by signing guys who are good at the penalty kill. Stop trying to plug a square peg into a round hole.
What about the quality of the competition he's been up against? I mean, you know, 2 years ago he was fifth on the Jets in quality of competition. Mm-hmm. Last year he was third.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he was still able to put up points that leaves you with a good feeling.
It makes you. It, what that indicates is that he's playing against the other team's top defensive pairing, and he's still producing. And I think that's a really good sign.
Absolutely, he's going up against the top defensive pairing of the opposite team, and there's something to be said for that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, looking at that top line again. To me, the weakest player on that line is Brian Little, but as far as Andrew Ladd and Blake Wheeler go this year, there weren't too many stretches that they weren't producing. And there weren't too many stretches last year, because last year was his career year with 64 points. Blake Wheeler is the type of guy, though, which is, and you know, talking about quality of competition, a lot of people that aren't familiar with that, that's, you know, it's pretty self-explanatory. But it's, you know, if you're going up against the other team's best players, simply put. And I think Blake Wheeler rises to the challenge. I think he's one of those players that he plays better against better teams, and I do think there is that inner drive for him to become a better player. Because let's be honest, guys, he didn't come into the NHL with a bang. It took him a while to adapt to the NHL game, because he was a top player for the University of Minnesota.
He was the fifth overall draft pick by the Coyotes, never played a game for the Coyotes, went to Boston, got traded from Boston to Atlanta, you know, on the year that the Bruins won the Cup.
That's right.
So, he has bounced around, you know.
Well, he...
Not bounced around, but, I mean, he's been...
Phoenix probably wasn't the happiest with him there.
Well, of course, because he chose not to sign. He didn't want to play in Phoenix. I mean, it's
too hot.
Still a team in Phoenix?
There is still a team in Phoenix, but
it's too hot.
There's a moratorium on discussing that team on the show. I don't know if you recall. Yeah. What's his ceiling? If everything clicks for Blake Wheeler, what's his ceiling as an NHLer?
Yeah, 70 to 75 point guy, I think, is the ceiling, and that's pretty good.
Oh, that's
point a game, basically.
Just under a point a game.
Yeah.
And what about the flip side? Everything collapses. I mean,
I think the contract you're going to be paying him, we'll talk about the numbers. I don't think there's he's that risky of a player. Even his poor years, you're probably talking 50 to 60. I think you're fine. I don't think it's a huge boom bust scenario here for a guy like this. And I think, you know, he likes the city as far as from people I've talked to. He enjoys the city. He likes playing with Little and Ladd. And I agree with Ezzy in terms of the inner drive. I think that's there, and I like his competitiveness. I think sometimes you could argue he's a little bit too sensitive to criticism. from the media and such. I think he's got this city isn't the most, you know, in terms of the media here isn't as harsh as, say, Montreal or other places. So I think he's got to be able to tune that out a little better. And maybe with age, he'll be able to do that. But you're nitpicking there. We're nitpicking there, too, because we're just talking about a really productive guy and some things he can work on.
Is he just, is he almost boring in that he's just a very solid NHL player who's, you know, doesn't have a huge range in what he's going to produce offensively? It's going to be between, like you said, 50 and 70 points. And he's just going to go out there sort of night in, night out, doing
it. It's whatever your prospect. It's like if you talk about a prospect now, if he can become that, you're all excited. And then he becomes that and he becomes boring, you know?
I don't think he is. I really think he's an exciting player to watch. He's become a fan favorite. And I think that, you know, we've seen a lot of highlight reel goals come from Blake Wheeler. And I think, you know, when we're talking about these guys being Bogosian and Wheeler, and then Little, I think Bogo and Wheeler are part of that core for the next 5 to 7 years. Bogo longer because he's younger, but I don't necessarily know that Little has to be part of that core. I think Wheeler, you have to sign because he's part of your core. He's a guy you pencil in as your top line right winger, whereas Bogo you pencil in as one of your top pairing defensemen. Little, I don't know if you pencil him as a top line center for the next five to seven years.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we'll discuss the offer sheet possibility, maybe a trade possibility. We're discussing Blake Wheeler and his RFA status. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, live on TSN 1290.